Welcome back to Coast. This hour, we'll take your phone calls as we continue chatting with Neil Howe about the fourth turning in American prophecy, what the cycles of history tell us about America's next rendezvous with destiny. Welcome back, Neil Howe, with us. We'll get your calls this hour as well. Neil, back to the millennials, and then we'll talk about the Generation Xers as well. Now, the millennials are also called what? Generation Y?
They were during much of the 1990s. Actually, that term was invented in 1993 by the magazine Ad Age. They actually came out with this issue. They talked about Generation Y. At that time, it was referring mainly to people born in the late 70s. Today, the people that today we would regard as Gen Xers. And then as time went on, by the late 90s, it began to be applied more to people born in the 1980s. Ultimately, you know, there was kind of a competition, and our term won. So there you got it. I think in 2005 or 6, Ad Age had a little article where they said, we're tossing in the towel. We're no longer talking about Generation Y, so I can't remember. In our office, I think we had a little champagne or something.
Well, let me ask you this, too. I mean, just over the last several years and recently, we have seen what Wall Street has done with digital media, Facebook, Snapchat, valuing them at billions of dollars. I mean, billions of dollars. And again, I asked my granddaughter, she's 22, she's part of my test. And I said, have you ever bought anything from an ad that you saw on Snapchat or Facebook? And she said, no. How do these places make money, Neil?
That's a great question. let me just say there are two aspects of social media sites. One of them sort of explains why people think they're valued highly. But the other aspect really speaks exactly to the concern that you raised and I share, okay? The one is that Facebook or Google and Snapchat, many of these sites, they have what economists call infinite returns to scale. And that's sort of the networking effect. Mm-hmm. You know, once you have enough people joining, it makes sense for everyone to join the same site. You know what I mean? There's no maximum limit. You know, if you're a steel manufacturer, you get to a certain size, you get any bigger, you get actually less efficient.
That's right.
You have several different steel manufacturers. This actually becomes an antitrust issue because, you know, there's only one Facebook, and it just gets bigger and bigger because everyone wants to join the same site. Okay, so that creates this kind of monopolistic, hegemonic kind of effect. You know, one company sort of does everything. But the other aspect, I'm glad you pointed that out. So far, most of these sites, and obviously many of them are different. You know, Amazon obviously is different. I mean, they're actually selling.
They're selling things.
Yeah, exactly. But with and you know and Apple is selling phones and so on. But you're right. These social media sites, they're selling ads. Well, here's the, I often tell this as a primer to investors. This is what I tell them. There's a little known fact about advertising. You can go back over a century, you can go back to 1900 and look at, we've reconstructed this. Advertising revenue as a share of GDP since 1900 has been incredibly constant. It's about 2.1 to about 2.2% of GDP every year. It never varies. The invention of radio, billboards, TV, internet, doesn't matter. It just squeezes the others out a little bit, but the total remains invariant. Well, the reason that's important is that what's happening is these social network sites are cannibalizing. They're taking away the ad revenue from the old media.
Yes, primarily newspapers, networks. By the way.
Well, the networks, and particularly the newspapers and magazines. But they're not inventing any new revenue. They're not going to grow faster than GDP forever.
Right.
They're just taking a bigger share of that fixed part of GDP, right?
That's right.
And I tell investors this. the only way that Facebook is going to justify its price in terms of its earnings multiple, if it grows, you know, twice as fast as GDP for the next 25 years.
And that's not going to happen. Not in terms of advertising revenue. It's not going to happen.
Exactly. They're going to have to invent entirely new businesses, and we're not sure what that is. Now, as you know, Google, I mean, it's into self-driving cars, and it's into longevity, and it's into space flight, and it's in, none of those things. All those things are losing money. I think that driverless cars actually are much further away than people think. But in any case, you're right. They are advertising machines, and that is limited. I think these companies are overvalued.
Way overvalued. The Snapchat euphoria, unbelievable. I mean, they said
well,
they did.
Also, and that's buoyed by the stock market right now, which is
yeah, that's true.
Out to lunch.
I mean, and so that bubble could go if the market goes. In a big way. We're going to get some calls, but I got a couple more questions here for you. And then many people want to just jump on board and ask you a question or two, Neil. As you look at what's happening with technology today, albeit let's put social media away for a second, but with technology, you mentioned driverless cars. Got picked up at the airport yesterday when I came back from Denver. We do TV shows out. And I'm looking at the driver doing his thing. And, you know, there's bumper-to-bumper traffic. It's in Los Angeles. It's just a mess. And I'm saying to myself, there's no way I will sit in the car in the back seat with no driver up there. I'm just not going to do it. I mean, yeah. If something happened or if somebody hacked the car and wanted to crash everybody one day, I'm just not going to do it. I don't see how that's going to catch on.
The AI and the sensors, the LIDAR and all the things they use, first of all, are nearly good enough. And secondly, you have a problem in that driverless cars have to be nearly perfect. And the reason is because users are going to regard them as products. So you have to understand, normally, the way we have driving today, there are, 35,000 deaths per year on American roads?
At least,
yeah. But it's governed, it's gone down a little bit. It's now around, 35,000. But it's governed by tort liability law, and it's governed by an old paradigm we've worked with for centuries, when it is individuals making decisions, and if they make fault, you know, we have a way of dealing with that, you know, imperfect as it is, but we're all kind of comfortable with that. But a driverless car is going to fall in a completely different ethical and kind of legal category, product liability, which means that anything that goes wrong
is a lawsuit.
It's going to put that company out of business.
Yeah, you're right.
And I sometimes say these left-brained, you know, Silicon Valley types, they say, well, driverless cars, you know, once we really perfect it, would reduce deaths to, you know, maybe 10,000. And my response is, you know, imagine the head of the Department of Transportation saying, you know, the good news is that we won't have any traffic deaths, you know, next year on our streets and highways. The bad news is we're going to have death squads randomly go out to random households and pull people out and shoot them on their front lawn, you know, 10,000 of them. And you see, that's how people will regard it. People will regard it as, when a car, for no reason, slams someone into a brick wall or goes straight into a...
And who do you give the ticket to? Because municipalities, police officers, Neil, will tell you, small municipalities, for their police departments, live and die by the tickets they write. What's going to happen? You're not going to have drunk drivers anymore. And who do you write the ticket to? If the car never, you know, or if it's speeding, it's not the guy in the back seat. You can't blame him.
You will sue the company, and you will empty its deep pockets, one or two accidents. And the problem is this, is you got all these great devices. A lot of people looking around and saying, driverless cars must be just around the corner because, you know, they prevent me from changing lanes, and they do all these great things, you know, these cars today. But the point is, it's a real problem now for these automakers, and they're already pulling back. You see, Tesla is now really pulling back from its claims. It's already sensing the liability problem.
Right.
As soon as they say, oh, you don't have to pay attention. Man, that message is the first thing that that defense lawyer will be telling the jury, right?
Could you imagine
how they're marketing this thing?
Taking a nap in the back seat of a driverless car?
Exactly.
There's no way. And what about flying cars? Talking about technology. I mean, we got enough problems with people ramming into each other now. What's going to happen if people are flying cars above you? They'll be dropping down on you like flies.
Well, yeah, that's
8 flying cars collided today over Los Angeles, and then they hit the poor guy who's driving on the freeway.
You know, Peter Thiel, who actually started, Palantir, and he was one of the first guys in PayPal and all that.
Along with Elon Musk.
He's probably the only big Silicon Valley guy who's a Trump supporter. Anyway, he founded his Thiel Fellowships, sponsoring all these young kids to invent things. And his motto was, he's really after manufacturing innovations, and he really disdains all the stuff that's being done in social networking and software. And the motto of his endeavors is basically, once upon a time we dreamed of flying cars, and all we got was 146 characters, right? So, that's his motto. Basically, we used to dream of an infrastructure which was actually material, change our material environment. And of course, as you know, George, our material environment has never changed less than it has over our lifetime.
And I've got to ask you this. As our lifetimes and our lifespans increase, what do you do with people who live longer and stay on the Social Security rolls a little longer?
Let me backtrack on that question. Lifespans increasing for who? As you know, and this is recent research out of Princeton, and it's being duplicated elsewhere, partly due to boomers bringing their bad habits into midlife. I'm talking about drinking. I'm talking about obesity, depression,
drugs,
suicide, opioids, among non-college whites. At age 55 for the last 10 years, life expectancy has been declining.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
So here's the
interesting
thing that's happening about boomers. Boomers actually show a bifurcation in life expectancy.
This is the first time.
At the educated end, the Silicon Valley end, these guys, these transhumanists and, all of that crowd.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're living longer. They're eating well, and
I'm concerned about the masses. Are the masses living longer overall or not?
Well, on the average, it's actually the last 3 or 4 years we've actually had flat age-adjusted mortality rates. So really, no improvement. I will say that in general, obviously, the long-term trend is toward improvement. I would have to say a shallow improvement, but I think what's more interesting is this spreading out. Anyone here saw the science fiction film Elysium?
Yes,
I think it was right.
Weird movie.
Yeah, well, in a way, that's kind of talks to you about the future we're moving toward. For those who can afford it, for those with the education, you're going to be living a lot longer, and there could be a lot of cures, a lot of acute cares that only you can afford to pay for.
That's right.
For everyone else, there's going to be a stripped-down, brutally elemental Medicaid. That's what you
right.
get.
They won't get the expensive stem cells or whatever you need to prolong your life.
And more importantly, the divergence in lifestyle. As you know, it's lifestyle, not acute care treatment, that determines longevity. And that's even more disturbing, right? This kind of differences in lifestyle. We talked about Trump. We talked about the Trump voter. I can't remember. There was a guy, one of the smartest bloggers on the Washington Post site, did a very interesting scattergram. You can go and look at it, the Washington Post, if you want. Basically took on Super Tuesday all the counties, something 1,000 counties voted on the Super Tuesday primary, and they plotted the percent of voting for Trump and the mortality rate at age 55. These were the counties.
So
perfect match. I mean, a nice kind of clouded line with a lot of spots. Okay,
and that was and he was accurate, I guess.
Well, yeah. In other words, Trump, you know, Trump America is an America in trouble. We all know that. But part of the trouble is, and Trump himself talks about that when he visited New Hampshire, when he went to Ohio, is the opioid epidemic. And he's looking at Gen Xers and Boomers. He's looking at people who are older. He's looking at what's happened to their lives. And it's not good right now.
They're abusing themselves.
Two different Americas going on here.
You're right. Let's take some calls, and we'll take some calls after the break. Let's go to Brian in Indianapolis to get things started east of the Rockies. Brian, go ahead.
Hey, George, Neil, good evening.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, listen, as an 18-year Teamster member, in no way, shape, or form do I agree with driverless anything on the road. I would never get behind the backseat of anything.
I want my Teamster truck driver to deliver the goods. I don't want some driverless truck.
That's right.
Are you long haul or short haul?
I'm sorry?
Do you do long haul driving, or is it local?
I'm local.
Yeah. Well, that'll be the last to be replaced, so I wouldn't worry about it.
All right. Well, I'm a tail end of a baby boomer. I just turned 55 this year, so I got about 10 years before I retire.
Yeah, and don't worry.
There's
always new demand for local delivery because everyone's having stuff delivered to their houses. So
right. Oh yeah, the drones and everything. But the Generation X, I feel are going to be just fine as far as taking leadership roles in our country. The millennials, they have no gravel in their gut. They have their thin skin, and you know, they maybe they'll learn as they get older, but they're going to have to toughen up because I'm going to be the grumpy old man on the grass.
Well, let me tell you, Brian, there are some goods. You know, I'm going to stand by my granddaughter, who's 22. She's a millennial, and if we had a million of her, we'd be in great shape. I mean, she's got her act together. She always didn't. Let me tell you, watching her grow up, there was a span. We had some trouble with her, but she popped out of it. And doesn't maturity do that, Neil, eventually?
Maturity brings, obviously, you know, like for all generations, it brings traits to fruition. It smooths away the rough edges. It takes traits and makes them productive in social ways. One of the wonderful things about generations, though, is the tendency of younger generations to be strong in areas where their parents aren't. This is actually a fundamental rule of generations that we explain in our early books, is that midlife parents tend to raise their kids not to be replicas of themselves, but to be complements of themselves. And you remember the World War II generation that was so strong on teamwork and building and doing everything by the rules raised their kids to be individualists with strong inner selves. And, of course, they became boomers who eventually, you know, staged days of rage and didn't want to fight their wars.
Well, but I got to tell you, my father's generation, that World War II group, wow, may have been the best. We're going to come back with final calls with Neil Howe. Let me quickly go through his books, Millennials Rising, The Fourth Turning, Generations. He's got more. We'll be back. Next hour, Heidi Hollis joins me as we talk about the Hat Men, Shadow People, and so many other strange things. Make sure you're part of the program. We're going to come back in a moment with Neil Howe and take final phone calls as well. Welcome back, Neil Howe, with us talking about trends. Neil, where are we in terms of the birth rate? Are we going up or going down?
It's not been looking good lately. You know, after the Great Recession in 2009, 10, 11, the birth rate went down. We had a kind of a high plateau during the millennial era. Do you remember the baby bust was Generation X? You know, very low births during the 1970s, and it resurged in the late 80s, and it kind of went up to, you know, well over. Total fertility rate of well over 2.1 births per woman per lifetime. And then it stayed at that level through most of the 1990s, the early 2000s. And then after the Great Recession, it began to plunge again. It's now down around 2.82. This is kind of European levels, Northern European levels. The United States used to be exceptional in having higher fertility than all of the other high-income countries. That's no longer true.
Well, do we want that? Do we want to have a higher fertility rate instead of
well,
a...
Well, that's a good question. Certainly it's good for the economy. It's good for projecting national power. It's good for, historically, I'll tell you, I have researched, national leaders talking about fertility going all the way back to the ancient Sumeria, and practically every national leader up until Malthus in the late 18th century unambiguously thought the higher fertility, the better, for our side, right? The interesting thing is today, is it a good thing? Well, it's a good thing for any one society. Is it good for the world? Fertility throughout the world is obviously slowing down. Through most of the world now, we are down around, replacement rate or lower. East Asia, including China, is now well under replacement rate. Latin America.
Well, China has laws on birth rates now, don't they?
Excuse me?
Doesn't China have laws on how many kids you can have?
Well, they have a one-child policy since the 1970s, but it's unclear whether those laws are really the reason why China has low fertility, because Chinese societies outside China, and I'm talking about Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, have about the same fertility. It's all down around, 1.8 or 1.6, 1.5. It's very low, okay?
Well, what do they do in China, Neil, if you have two kids when the law says one? They take one away?
Well, in the cities where that's enforced the most, in the countryside they don't enforce it as much. In the cities where they enforce it, the penalty is basically you're taxed, and you also have to the ultimate penalty is you have to pay for your own child's education and health care. The state doesn't really pay for it. It's mainly the elite that can afford it, and the elite can skirt the laws.
Yeah,
as you know, China is very much a society that gives more privileges to those with money.
China has 1.357 billion people, India 1.252.
India is growing much faster because India remains above the replacement rate. India is about a 2.4 TFR, total fertility rate, whereas, China's way down around, 1.6, 1.7. So in about, within 10 years,
they're going to catch
India will surpass China in total population. But here's the thing, George, the only part of the world that is truly growing fast in terms of population is South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. And the only way that can continue is that if you believe that, according to the UN projection, that Nigeria can, quintuple its population, have three times the population of Western Europe by the year 2050, I don't think that's going to happen.
They can't even feed the people they have now.
That's my point. So I think that these projections are overestimating the gain we're going to see.
All right, let's take some final calls here. Let's go to Kevin in Chico, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Kevin, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Thanks, George, for your call.
Sure.
My question, I have three questions, and I'll take it offline.
Okay.
I just wanted to do it really quick. He was talking about inflation, and I just want to see how soon he thinks we are going to see inflation or hyperinflation.
Okay.
And the second one is the population of, the college students that are millennials that have huge debt, and with, the exponential technology that's going on, where he sees, job placement. And the third is, if Trump is successful in disrupting global economics, how are those millennials going to fit in our country as far as getting jobs and paying off their debt?
All good questions.
They have.
All right, let's start with inflation. We're at the small rate, 1.6% right now.
Yeah, we've had, obviously, the fears of deflation since the Great Recession, and central banks have gone to NERP and ZERP and doing everything they can to stimulate inflation. I think one interesting thing that's happening now is that, and you see the Fed policy, Fed's begin, you know, the Fed is raising interest rates. Central Bank of, you know, of Japan, the European Central Bank, they're all talking now about raising rates. And I think you really saw this in the personal consumption expenditure data in last month in that came out for January, where you saw that the personal consumption expenditure deflator, which is what the Fed follows, it would look like a target of 2.0. It's now at that year over year is 1.9. So that's basically back up to where the Fed wants it. And the month over month was something like 5.3. So right recently, we're seeing a decided acceleration of inflation. And this, you have to understand that this acceleration feeds on itself, because the more acceleration there is in inflation, the Fed keeping interest rates low actually further accelerates the growth, because then the real rates are even lower. It builds on itself, and it could run away from the Fed very easily. I'm beginning to think that now stagflation could really be the new danger coming down the road, which could get people by surprise. You know, we'll have to see.
Now, what about college debt?
College debt is the
new
mortgage. It's the new mortgage for millennials. So among millennials at, say, around age, you know, 28, 29, age 30, per capita, every form of debt has been declining since Generation X at that age. Every form of, I mean, car debt, housing debt, credit card debt, except, of course, student debt, which is taking its place. And, you know, a lot of people complain about millennials for being self-oriented, you know, self-centered and impatient. This is a generation which is radically cutting back on consumer debt in favor of the one form of debt it feels it cannot afford not to spend, which is money on colleges, which they regard as an investment. So I would say this is a generation that, look, you know, the inflation of college tuition and college costs is no fault of its own, right? It's the policies of older people are setting these prices, and it's doing all within its power to adapt. Despite these higher prices, Americans aged 25 to 30 today have the highest college attainment rates in American history. So I think we should all congratulate millennials. Despite these very high costs, they're going to school and actually getting degrees more than any other cohort that has come along. So, you know, kudos.
By the way, I wanted to pass on that your co-author, William Strauss, who wrote the book with you, The Fourth Turning, is no longer with us. He passed away about, what, eight, 9 years ago?
Yeah, 2007, yes.
Yeah, I mean, and you two were pretty good partners putting these together.
Yes, we wrote a lot together.
Let's go to some more final calls here. Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Hi, Frank. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you. Thank you for bailing me out the other day on the, you say no question is a dumb question on Coast to Coast.
That's right.
My question, Mike, I have a question and a prediction.
All right.
The prediction is within a week of Halloween or within a week before Halloween or a week after Halloween, Kim Jong-un's generals are going to get rid of him.
I think you might be right. I've always said there's going to be a coup.
A poisoning that they're going to call a stroke. And his generals, they want to live and play with their grandchildren, too. Now, my question is, what would be the problem with, as health care, to take it out of everyone's paycheck, just like you would Social Security or income tax.
Let's get your take on that. Now, you know, most of us...
What was that last question? I'm sorry.
Well, what about for health care, just deducting it from everybody's checks? But I do have to say, most of us who are insured through company policies do get some money taken out of our checks. That does happen already.
Well, yeah. I mean, look at it this way. The employer doesn't care whether they pay you cash or whether they pay, you know, the doctors on your behalf. So if they could cash you out, they would gladly do it. So to an economist, there's no question that you know, rising healthcare costs eats into your paycheck, right? I think any economist would tell you that.
Your deductibles go up and everything else.
Well, yeah, it just takes away the, what they can pay you in terms of cash. I mean, if you agreed to cash out and get no healthcare, they could pay you more. Now, one reason why you would still prefer to get your healthcare from your employer is that it's deducted from your income tax. You don't have to pay taxes on it.
That's
right.
Right. Right.
So the fact that we allow people to pay for their health care in after tax dollars is a big subsidy, and of course it subsidizes most those at higher incomes. This is a big problem in the Republican Party because, you know, they want to limit, even Obamacare had limits, you know, the so-called Cadillac tax, right, on the big expensive health care plans and the plushest of the Fortune 500 companies. Well, even a lot of Republicans think that's a bad policy, that we should be subsidizing, you know, the healthcare spending of upper income people by giving them, you know, tax exemptions, right? So this is a big issue. I do believe the problem with, you know, the repeal and replace is going to be a huge burden on those who are just above the Medicaid line. You know, they're going to have to pay a lot more. A lot of them will have to go without care.
They can't afford this.
But we're doing nothing to curtail subsidies to very comfortable and affluent Americans. With regard to North Korea and putting away with...
the generals. Doing.
Yeah, the generals. Well, as you know, there were a lot of generals who wanted to do away with Pol Pot. There's a lot of generals who wanted to do away with Adolf Hitler. And as you recall,
they tried,
and they almost did it, but they failed. So
yeah.
We can't count on that.
Maybe the people who killed his half brother could spray him with whatever he sprayed them.
There we go. That would be they would have to get close first.
Why don't we send Dennis Rodman back, who went there years ago? They seem to get along. And have him just negotiate this peace thing.
Yeah, Dennis Rodman negotiating peace. That would be interesting.
It sure would.
That would quite an out-of-character experience.
Tyler in Aurora, Colorado, happens to be a first-time caller. You're up with us. Tyler, go ahead.
Hi, George. It's an extreme honor to be on the show. Well,
thank you. Glad you got in.
Thank you enough for what you do.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Yeah, okay. I'll be under a minute. I just wanted to know your thoughts on the prison industrial complex and how the generations are going to affect it.
The prison industrial complex. And I want you to explain that a little bit more for us.
George. I'm sorry, what?
Explain that a little bit more for us.
Yeah, do you think it's going to grow bigger, maybe less? As you probably know, you have a huge prison audience.
Oh, they're huge. They are.
Yeah.
Number one in prisons.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting thing that's going on in prisons, and let me just talk about this as a demographer, and that is to say the prison population is aging, okay? And it's really fascinating that they're now building geriatric wards onto prisons. So you've got a lot of boomers who are aging in prison. Boomers are still committing today higher crime rates than people did 20 years ago, even in their, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. Meanwhile, millennials are actually committing a lot less crime than, you know, Xers did back in the mid-1990s. In fact, you know, serious violent crime for youth has plummeted over the last 20 years. You know, despite what everyone talks about, the Ferguson effect and everything else, it's still way down. Which is why cities are so much safer, which is why millennials are actually moving back into cities, right? They're safer.
Except Chicago.
Live there again, right?
Except Chicago, right?
Well, Chicago, even Chicago's lower than it was in the mid-90s, but obviously Chicago is worse than most other cities, granted. But believe me, I lived in Manhattan in the 80s. I visited L.A. in the early 90s. You would not have a lot of, you know, yuppies back then moving into those places, but you do today. Cities are much safer. There's a lot less crime. But here's the point about prisons, is that the share of people in their 20s is actually declining as a share of the prison population, and a lot of the Xers and boomers are aging in place there. I do think that There's also a change going on, and obviously not throwing people, you know, throwing away the key, three strikes, you're out. Public attitudes are changing on the laws, and I think we're doing a less, you know, long-term incarceration for minor nonviolent offenses. I think in long-term, we're going to move more toward a, you know, behavioral sort of outpatient thing where a lot of people who are not violent can be treated, you know, outside prison walls more humanely and more effectively.
Well, I think they should open up the doors right now to all the petty pot offenders who are in there and just let them all go.
Well, there you go. And to some extent, that has either happened because of overcrowding. You look in California as a good example, your state, where they're already selectively releasing people. But the point is that I think prisons will change, but I think they're changing demographically in an interesting way as well.
Neil's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His books are all on amazon.com as well. Neil, let's take another call or two. Let's go to Dan, the blind man in Washington, D.C. Dan, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, George, you know I'm Dan, the blind man of the angels, you know.
Yes, you are.
And sir, first of all, before I bring up my question, I'm going to tell you a special surprise that Gina Salvati has. She has a special surprise for you and Neil Howe. And she will tell you about that after you're off the air.
All right, great. Now, we only have 30 seconds
right,
for your question. Go ahead.
Have you ever heard of demographically what is called the angry white belt?
The angry white belt. Have you heard that? And only have 30 seconds, Neil.
I don't know. I which part of America are you talking about?
I would guess that's right in the middle. Heartland of America, I guess.
Okay, I guess that's kind of your Scots-Irish hillbilly belt. By the way, there's a great book, if you haven't read it, it's by a millennial. It's called Hillbilly Elegy. And I think anyone who really wants to understand kind of that kind of, you know, poor white kind of quintessential Trump voter growing up in this case, he talks about his own.
That's an interesting book. Neil, thank you for being on the program. Look, it's been way too long. Way too long since you were on with me last, so let's make sure we make this a little more current. I will come back in a moment with Heidi Hollis as we talk about true stories of evil encounters.